hour and a half.
Okay. Thanks a lot of them, Boris and Andy and all the other organizers for having me. Thanks to you guys for showing up. Is it halfway through the third week? So you're at about like 70% depletion right now. So hopefully you will survive through the rest of this week and through the next 90 minutes. So as always, I mean, you've been here a while now, and for those of you who haven't, this is the KIQP, so every 3 minutes, every 3 words, you're definitely expected to interrupt with a question about clarification. So please feel free to interrupt at any time if there's anything that you don't understand or that I'm not making clear. So what I'm going to be talking about is our perspective, my lab's perspective, on how we can use less studied model organisms in the lab to reveal not only ideally new information about how biological systems put themselves together, but also the evolution of the systems, of the genetic control systems that put cellular organisms together. This is why we study more than one organism in the lab, and every data point that we get in the lab, we're concerned not only with an internal reference, but with an external reference, which is the reference of organismal evolution on this planet. We'd like to know if we discover a particular molecular mechanism, not just is there another cell in this organism that also uses this molecular mechanism, but is there another cell type in any other organism that uses this molecular mechanism? How widespread is the use of this mechanism for this cell type across animals, across eukaryotes, across all kingdoms of life? And how do the genes that control these molecular mechanisms function in these different scenarios? And ultimately, how did these genes evolve? Where did they come from in the first place? Genes that direct coordinated movements of cells to create stable multicellular organisms. These are the big questions that drive our interest. So in the next 90 minutes, I'll give you a few of the pieces of sort of logic that we use to drive our choice of different model organisms, and then I'll give you a couple of brief examples of things that we've discovered using some less studied model organisms that we definitely wouldn't have discovered if we had stuck with the traditional model organisms, which we think are really exciting. And then in the last half of the talk, I will tell you about our new explorations into using quantitative analysis of images to try to understand what these white dots are doing on the black background, which are nuclei that then become cells that put together an embryo that's going to make a cricket. I don't want to commit the sin of a demonstration without explanation, so let me finish explaining everything that is on this slide. And this is a time series in dorsal view on the right-hand side, which are on your left, and in lateral view further from me of development progressively from top to bottom of this cricket embryo from early cleavages through to just before hatching. You'll see a little bit more of that as we go on. So we have these, you know, sort of big five, and I guess if you're a chicken fan, you could include it as a six if you think that you can do chicken genetics. These sort of traditional genetic model organisms have provided, of course, tremendous insights into how organisms work and how cells make decisions about doing things during multicellular development, and you've learned a lot about these ways in the last few weeks. And these are fantastic organisms. I'm not knocking them. I was trained in Drosophila. If you put a gun to my head and you said you can only work on one animal for the rest of your life, Drosophila melanogaster, hands down, no choice. I mean, I don't even have to think about it for a minute. Definitely, definitely. Superior genetic manipulation. That's what I'm interested in. But since nobody's got a gun to my head for that question right now, I want to point out to you that these traditional model organisms are representing, or, I mean, nothing represents anything except itself, but they are illustrating they're members of clades that are a tiny fraction of animal diversity. This is a limited tree of the phylogenetic relationships between most major animal phyla. There may be 10 missing, but these are a lot of big ones. Okay, so deuterostomes are down here, and you are a vertebrate, so this is where you are, and these are your nearest neighbors, and these are protostomes over here. Protostomes and deuterostomes, together with acaeal flatworms, are bilaterian animals. They have an axis of bilateral symmetry that's very obvious. And then we have our outgroups to these, corals, anemones, sponges, and comb jellies, or actinophores. I'm not trying to come down hard on the side of actinophores being the most basally branching animals right now. I'm just saying they probably are. Okay, so where are the traditional model organisms that we have studied on the last few weeks and that you probably study in your labs? We have the nematode worms, C. elegans, here in the nematodes, the roundworms. Drosophila melanogaster is an arthropod. And all of the other traditional models, even if you want to throw in the chicken, are vertebrates. And of course, the sea squirts that you learned about from Patrick the other day are right here, sister to the vertebrates. So we're very vertebrate heavy. Protostomes are poorly represented, and invertebrates are poorly represented. And invertebrates are something like 95% of all animals. And of those
invertebrates, 95% of them are arthropods. And of those arthropods, over 90% of them are insects. Okay. So if you're just counting up species, we're poorly representing the tree of life. We only restrict our gaze to these organisms. Okay. So what I want to talk about, there's three sections in this talk. I want to talk about things that we, as a scientific community, have generally considered as factors when we bring model organisms into the lab, and other factors that we can additionally consider besides basically convenience, okay, which is a big one. I want to show you a couple of examples of discoveries that we've made using non-traditional model organisms, which has been exciting. And then I'll tell you about some of the tools and approaches that we're trying to take to apply quantitative image analysis to the development of one of these guys, this cricket. And this third part is very, very new. It has started less than a year ago in my lab, and I'm looking forward to your feedback and input on that part. Okay, so how have we traditionally, and how might we going forward, choose different organisms for study in the lab? And I'm just going to be very animal-centric right now because that's what's going to happen. Okay, so we're talking about traditional model organisms, and what I want to illustrate to you here is that traditional model organisms, all those five that I put up on the thing, and even you can count chickens, are relatively derived clades within their larger phylogenetic groupings. Okay, so mice are highly derived relative to mammals. Zebrafish are highly derived relative even to bony fish, let alone to all fish. Flies are highly derived relative to insects and arthropods. And terrestrial nematodes, C. elegans, are derived relative to nematodes as a clade. Okay. And frogs are derived relative to amphibians. Okay. So, and one thing, yes, Madhav.
What does the word derived mean?
What I mean by derived is that they share relatively fewer, let me see. When I say conserved or ancestral, what I mean is that when we, based on what we can know and imagine and make up, we imagine that a last common ancestor at some node in a phylogenetic tree that we're interested in had certain characteristics. If an organism that we're studying today, an extant organism, has those characteristics, we would call those shared characteristics. If the organism that we're studying today, the fruit fly, has characteristics that have evolved after it diverged from that last common ancestor that are new and unique to that clade, did not exist in the ancestor, we call those things derived. So conserved and derived, ancestral and derived, are only ever relative terms. Basal is a nonsense term because it has no relative meaning. Basally branching is a meaningful thing, and then you have to say which branch are you talking about. So yeah, thank you, that's a good question. Okay. If you're raising your hand, idols, please just yell. All right, so what do these derived organisms have? What are some of the things that are making me say that they share, that they have a number of features that of embryogenesis, of development, that are derived relative to their ancestral siblings? One thing that they share is that many, many body plan elements, you've learned about dorsiventral, anterior, posterior patterning, and so on, are established with a heavy reliance on maternal determinants and a heavy reliance on early asymmetric segregation, cellularly or within a cytoplasm, of these determinants that are provided either maternally or extremely early, organized extremely early in development. The basally branching sisters of our traditional model organisms tend to rely more on zygotic activation and cell signaling at relatively later stages of development, and tend to rely less on essentially pre-patterning animal during oogenesis. So here's an example of Drosophila, which, as you know, is heavily reliant on maternal determinants, and crickets, which I will tell you right now, are, we believe, less reliant on maternal determinants to create quite as many elements of their body plan. We know, for example, that in Drosophila, and in many flies and mosquitoes, which are the sisters of Drosophila, not only all of these axes, but every part of the body, the head, the thorax, the abdomen, the three major regions of insect bodies, are all planned out. All of the segments are essentially mapped out already, right, from the beginning of that maternally driven cascade that will lead to the establishment of all of the segments. In contrast, most insects, certainly all the basally branching insects, and this is a blanket statement that you could apply more or less accurately to most arthropods, in their very first early development and in the establishment of what will become their embryonic rudiment, which is the orange area here, that's what will become the whole embryo, they have established only the head and the thorax region. The abdomen, in a sense, doesn't exist yet. Only the cells that will build the abdomen exist, and they are a very small group of cells, and they need to, through proliferation and patterning, create the abdomen and divide it into segments, not unlike what you've seen in some vertebrate systems. All right. And these orange and blue regions are supposed to show you the relative amount of the early cellular material at the blastoderm stage that is dedicated to the embryo, which is in orange here, or to the extraembryonic tissue, which is in blue here. And as you learned in Drosophila, most of the blastoderm cells go into making up the embryo, and a very tiny group of dorsal cells create an extraembryonic membrane called the amniocerosa. Polyploid membrane does some things. In most insects, the vast majority, certainly of the surface area, although I don't know about cell counts, but I think it's also cell number, are dedicated to making the extraembryonic membranes, which are two in number and complex and required for development. And so this is, again, typical of most insects. So these are just a couple of features where the features that Gryllus displays are so widely displayed and so consistently displayed in the basally branching members of the clade that we hypothesize that they are ancestral features. And this is directly going to Madhav's question. By extension, these features of Drosophila, we will call them derived here. What are some reasons that people have chosen models to work with in the lab? It's convenience. It's all about convenience, right? Lab work is hard. You can't be slaving away just to keep the mammals alive. They have to develop quickly. You can't be waiting around all the time. They have to get to sexual maturity quickly so that you can get many generations of offspring, particularly if you're a geneticist. That's important to you. You want large population sizes so that your statistics have power. And you have to have them relatively tolerant to environmental variability because, let's face it, you might not go in on Sunday and feed them and they still have to survive, right? So all of our traditional model organisms that we tend to use for genetics and development are very good at responding to these human-selected pressures. Interestingly, these animals that are basically garbage animals that can tolerate terrible conditions all of the time tend to be the ones, when you look at the phylogenetic distribution of them and their developmental characteristics, that have these heavy reliance on early maternal development. They develop extremely quickly, they gastrulate with relatively few cells, and their body elements, their body plan elements are established very early with less reliance on zygotic information. So I don't know, I couldn't say, you know, people often ask me this, is there some kind of evolutionary explanation, some kind of selective pressure explanation that would help us understand why developing quickly would lead to this early reliance on maternal plans, for example. And people have made the sort of hand-waving suggestion, and we would call it an argument, that, well, if you just make sure that everything is taken care of during oogenesis, then when you're fertilized, you can just go right away. You don't have to spend time doing the transcription and the translation and the reorganization of all of that information because you've already got it preloaded. I don't know if anybody's really quantified these times and seen, you know, I mean, how much longer would it actually take? I don't know. But that is an argument, a sentence that is put forward. Okay. All right, so let me tell you about then, we're going to be talking a lot about Gryllus, this cricket that we like right now, and I'm going to be comparing some of its lab-friendly attributes to those of Drosophila melanogaster. So Drosophila melanogaster, as you now know, is very easy to culture. There's a massive and relatively friendly scientific community internationally, which is a large strength. It's a really strong strength. It's a big strength of Drosophila as a system. There is a completely sequenced and very well annotated publicly available genome. You can get embryos all the time, all day, all year. Year 365, you can get 24-hour embryogenesis, that's very fast. They'll reach sexual maturity in 10 days, and they have the most powerful genetics of any animal model organism. So our crickets, we like them a lot for these reasons. They are also extremely easy to culture. They live in Tupperware containers, they can live at relatively high density, they are pretty non-picky when it comes to food. If you don't feed them, they'll just eat each other. That's not what we want, so we give them food. We feed them on grains and cat food. They really like cat food. Okay. We have a number of different transcriptomes and a draft genome that our colleague Taro Mito in Japan is in the process of assembling. So we can get genes and pretty good complete sequences, a genomic sequence for most of the things that we want at this stage. We can get embryos all the time, every day. They don't have a breeding season. They're not seasonal, right? So all the time, their embryogenesis is 10 days long, and their time to sexual maturity is about 6 weeks. So it's definitely longer than Drosophila, but it's not worse than working with mice. And we can also perform RNA interference, and CRISPR-Cas9 system can allow us to put things in and out of the genome, and the piggyback transposon system can allow us to make transgenic crickets as well, as Taro Nakamura, who you know from the course here, has done. One thing that, you know, you can't get around, we have not yet devised a system to do what Drosophila embryologists do, which is to study embryology without ever touching embryos, right? You just collect them with paintbrushes and you put them into tubes and they're like grains of sand, these Drosophila embryos. You can literally do your whole career in Drosophila embryology and never touch an embryo. In Gryllus, you can't get away with that. You actually have to remove the embryo by hand from its egg.
But the eggs are really large. They're about 4 or 5 times the size of Drosophila, so if you're used to feeling, they're larger in some dimensions than a zebrafish embryo. So once you get used to doing that, you can peel them pretty easily. And I'll show you in a couple of slides what the embryo looks like and why you have to pull it out of that egg yolk. Okay, so let me talk about some of the derived and ancestral features that we went to gorillas to be able to assess. We know that Drosophila is a member of the holometabolous insects. These are a monophyletic clade of insects that are relatively far removed from a last common insect ancestor, and they go through complete metamorphosis. That means that they have a pupa or a chrysalis or a cocoon stage. And that also means that this metamorphosis process, what we mean by that specifically in insects, is that the product of embryogenesis is not the exact same body plan as the final adult form. It is an intermediate form, a larval form, a caterpillar, a maggot, whatever you want to call it, that then has to transform, undergo metamorphosis to achieve the final adult body plan. Okay. The ancestral state of insect and animal development, we believe, is hemimetabolous or direct development, whereby the product of embryogenesis is an exact physical copy of the adult body plan. It's just physically smaller, and through a process of cell proliferation and cell enlargement needs to achieve a final body size. But there is no radical redoing of body plan. Okay. Drosophila melanogaster undergoes what we call Langevin development, whereby during early embryogenesis, all of the segments are established essentially simultaneously. Whereas what an ancestral state for arthropods is what we call short-term development, which is analogous in some way to the vertebrate development that you've heard about, whereby only some of the segments are established during early embryonic processes, and the terminal segments of the abdomen need to be added on in an anterior to posterior sequential fashion. This is related to what I just said. The segments in Drosophila are established almost simultaneously. I mean, it's not down to the second, but in melanogaster, certainly within 2 minutes of each other, I believe, all of the segments are established. And here we have sequential segmentation that takes place over a period of a few days. One segment is added every several hours. The nurse cells that you may have heard about in Drosophila melanogaster, which are critical to this maternally heavy reliant system of providing axial determinants and so on, is absent ancestrally in insects because the nurse cell system is absent. So the nurse cells are these polyploid nutritive cells that are connected by these fascinating ring canals that Stas talked about. And their organization within that egg chamber, and they are providing through active translation and transcription and active transport to the oocyte and then assembling within the oocyte all these important determinants. Nurse cells are a derived feature that are found only in holometabolous insects, and there are a couple of annelids that have nurse cells and maybe one or two other animal clades. Most insects don't have nurse cells, and their ovaries, we call them panoistic, just means they don't have nurse cells. And what this means then is that the oocyte nucleus of these animals is active translationally in the cytoplasm. And if there is any subcellular organization or provision of maternal determinants required for early development, that single oocyte nucleus has to do it by itself. As I showed you in the little blue and orange diagram, Drosophila has this reduced extraembryonic membrane called the amnio serosa, which is a derived fusion of what ancestrally were two large extraembryonic membranes separately called the amnion and the serosa that play different roles in development. Drosophila dedicates most of its early cells to making the embryo, whereas gorillas and most insects dedicate just a small portion of those cells to making the embryo, and it perches on top of the yolk and is surrounded by extraembryonic cells. Drosophila melanogaster does not undergo a series of fascinating movements within the eggshell, which are called blastokinesis, but these movements are characteristic of insect embryos, and you'll see them in a video that I'll show you on the next slide. The embryo inside the eggshell does a bunch of somersaults, basically. It reverses its dorsiventral and anterior-posterior axis relative to the egg, and then it unreverses both of those axes, so that at the very beginning of development, when the rudiment is formed, its AP and DB axes are aligned with those of the egg and with those of the mother, right? The eggs are laid posterior side down. And it reverses those halfway through development, and then it unreverses them so that when the animal hatches, it is in the same orientation as it was when it was first born. Okay, so in this movie, you're going to see this movie on the top was made with white instant light under a stereo microscope, and the shots are taken every 5 minutes or so. And this is not the same embryo, it's a different embryo, and Seth has nicely morphed together a combination of a time-lapse image of this transgenic cricket that Taro Nakamura made in his previous lab, this histone 2B EGFP line that's expressing GFP fusion to histone 2B in every cell. So you'll see every nucleus. And then
later on, after the embryo gets to a stage where we actually want to see what's happening in the embryo, Seth has done some nuclear-stained embryo morphs so that you can see what's happening with the embryo, because as you'll see in the white light image, the embryo is only visible when it first forms as a little transparent strip. It's going to form in this posterior ventral region. Then it's going to sink into the ovum, be covered by the ovum on all sides, and we can't see it with white light. So that's what you'll see here in the bottom. So we have some relatively, but you'll see a little bit later on, we're trying to quantify these nuclear divisions forming a blastoderm that we couldn't really call uniform very easily. We have assembly of an embryonic rudiment at the posterior ventral side that we call into the germ band, and all the rest of it is extraembryonic tissue. So that thin transparent strip there is the embryo, and it's sinking into the yolk, as you can see from these static images with nuclear dyes that are showing on the bottom. So now it's reversing its axis, and the posterior of the embryo is now going to face the anterior of the egg. And here's what the embryo looks like when you take it out of that yolk, and over time, it is changing. It's got all of these abdominal segments now. It's getting larger. Its appendages are growing. This is all happening inside the yolk, which is why we have to take out the embryos to see these processes. The appendages are getting longer and jointed. The anterior of the embryo, remember, inside the egg is actually facing the posterior of the egg. But soon it's going to come out of this serosa-bounded region. It's reversing its dorsiventral axis and somersaulting so that now it reorients, so its head is once again facing the anterior of the egg. Through the transparent eggshell, now we can see these muscle contractions, and we can see the process of dorsal closure and enclosure of the remaining yolk, which is sucked into the embryonic gut just before hatching is about to take place. That procedure takes about 10 days at 28 degrees Celsius, yes.
Is there any explanation why they do the double somersault yet? Is there a...
There is not. So what one would want to do would be to prevent it from happening somehow and see what consequences that had. And we don't know of any specific genes, for example, that are responsible for that. I'm sure there would be a lot of trivial things that we could do if we halted cell division or stop the microtubules or something like that, we'd stop it, but that would be a trivial thing. So we don't know. We don't know. We know that Drosophila doesn't do it. It looks fine. But it also doesn't have the extensive extraembryonic membranes that we think are involved in this process that we think might allow it to occur. Yeah.
So do they develop at a normal rate and normally in the absence of yolk? I mean, without being fed from the yolk? Well, you're taking them out of the egg.
Oh, I see. Right. So, okay, so these are not, sorry, I should have clarified. These are not, this moving thing down here is not actually a time lapse. It's just a morph of different stills. Yeah.
So how far will they develop if you can isolate
them? So the furthest that Taro has been able to get them, Taro, correct me if I'm wrong, is that he can take them out when they're just about to begin forming abdominal segments. So when they're still, they haven't yet turned around. And he can get them to develop to the stage where they can develop at least 3 or 4 segments in culture. Is that right, Carl? I don't know.
Yeah.
So 3 or 4 segments in culture. We haven't tried further. My guess is that if we left them in culture and, you know, all else being equal, they didn't get infected, they would develop all of their segments and elongate their appendages. But I don't think that in the culture dish they would undergo anything that would tell us anything about the somersaults. Yeah.
Isn't that saying that somersaults are not terribly important for development?
No, I'm not. I'm saying that we have no way of assessing whether or not they are at the moment. All we can say is that they occur.
Have you ever tried puncturing the serosa or reducing the serosa, because that must be involved?
It definitely is. And so if you puncture the serosa, you've broken some kind of tension, and I'm just saying that because you see it by Ospain. We have not measured that clinical tension. We could do that type of thing. And then you don't get it. Matt, you're Matt.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that a lot of these movements are reduced or absent in the entire whole metabolite. So even the really short-term things from the beetles and so on, they don't do this crazy, like, inversions and so on.
Yes.
It's not absolute, but most of the descriptions for the whole metabolite do without these.
Yeah. So a lot of classical embryology in the 50s and 60s involved doing what Akanja is suggesting, puncturing the serosa or the amnion. The amnion is, covers it on the ventral side, and the serosa is covering it all around the other side. Puncturing these membranes, the serosa, for example, is what is enclosing that blob of yolk up at the top. Puncturing those things at different times relative to blastocinesis, and basically, if there is any break in tension in that membrane system, you cannot do the somersaults. And then people would argue about whether or not it was a pulling force on the part of the serosa or these membranes, or if it was some kind of active pushing force on the part of the yolk within it. And again, it's very difficult. It's not unlike the sort of cytoplasmic flows that you see in the Drosophila oocyte that have something to do with microtubules and plus and minus and directed motor proteins. But it's very difficult to find conditions where you can disrupt only one of those elements without disrupting all of the rest of them, so that the causal arrow direction is at this stage, on it's you can't only make it in one direction. We just don't know. Okay. Other questions about the cricket development? Okay. Oh, yes.
I can ask you, you in that a few slides earlier, you said Drosophila has much more maternal patterning versus crickets. Mm-hmm. When I look at that movie, what for you can you say is something novel that's not maternally patterned, that's sort of more self-organized? I'm sure you sort of,
The abdomen. The abdominal segments and the germline. Certain polarity is present at the end of oogenesis, for sure. The eggs are very asymmetrical, AP, DV, definitely. We're doing an experiment now where we've cut the early oocytes and the very early embryos in half, halfway down the AP axis, and we've sequenced the transcripts in either side, and they're not the same. And next year, maybe I'll be able to tell you something more specific than that. Yeah, there was a question at the back.
I was just wondering whether the early cell divisions are stereotypic or not.
Not as much as Drosophila, but to some extent. So I'll get to that in the third part of the talk. We're trying to figure out now to what extent. Yeah. Okay. All right. So to summarize that first part, traditional laboratory organisms that we choose for convenience sometimes, turns out, have features that may limit our phylogenetic inference. And so if you're asking about not only how does development work, but how did development evolve, then it's useful to think about the relative phylogenetic placement of these things and the relative ancestral or derived nature of the characteristics that you're interested in. And in order to place findings from Drosophila melanogaster into some kind of evolutionary context, it can be very useful to have alternative models that branch more basally within the tree and that display what we think are closer to ancestral features of development. And Grylls, we're excited about Grylls right now because it's really easy to work with. Okay. So I'm going to tell you about a couple of things that we've discovered using Grylls that were very surprising to us that we wouldn't have discovered if we had continued to focus on Drosophila alone. And this has to do with the establishment of germ cells, and these are the cells that will create eggs and sperm in sexually reproducing organisms. And so they're an interesting link, not only between the field of developmental biology, because establishing a germline is a cell specification problem, but also evolutionary biology, because if you are an obligately sexually reproducing organism, then only the DNA of your germlines will make it into the next generation. So in some very strict sense, only the DNA of the germline is important in an evolutionary sense, because it's only those allele changes that are getting transmitted from one generation to the next. And so how do animals make germ cells then? They establish their germlines, as they do many other cell types during early embryogenesis, and they do so, roughly speaking, in one of two ways. They can use what I'll call this inheritance way, which involves during oogenesis, which is this top row here schematic. During oogenesis, there are maternally synthesized determinants of the germline, which I've put here in red. These are mRNAs and proteins and different organelles that collectively create a special cytoplasm called germplasm that is inherited by only some cells, the cells that will form in that specific physical region of the embryo after fertilization. Those cells, by virtue of inheriting the cytoplasm, independently of any zygotic activity of their own genome, will become germ cells. So the germplasm here is a necessary and sufficient driver of cell fate, and zygotic activity is not only absent in the case of Drosophila, but it's just not important. Okay, it's not required for this. So this is the inheritance mode, based on cytoplasmic determinants that are necessary and sufficient. And many people in previous lives, in previous experiments, have done things where they physically remove the germplasm or physically transplant the germplasm to ectopic places, or you can compromise the genes that encode the materials of the germplasm or ectopically express those genes in different regions and thus ectopically create germplasm. And all of these experiments have supported this hypothesis of the necessity and sufficiency of germplasm here and the lack of importance of zygotic gene activity or cell-cell signaling to establish this particular type of cell. That's one way that some animals do it, including almost every model organism we've heard about so far. Okay. The other way that some animals make their germ lines is through a mechanism that I'm going to call induction. In this mechanism, during oogenesis, there are no maternally deposited cytoplasmic contents that are necessary nor sufficient to establish a germline. Instead, to make a germline, you need to do what you need to do to make most somatic cell types, which is you need to signal. Cells need to talk to each other. The receiving cells, the red cells that receive these blue signals from their neighboring somatic cells, will respond to those signals by becoming germ cells. So this inducted mechanism is reliant on cell-cell signals, not on maternal patterning. And even though until recently it had only been described at the molecular level in two vertebrates, a mouse and salamander, based on the phylogenetic distribution of how animals appear to be establishing their germlines, I hypothesized some time ago that probably the cell-cell signaling mechanism was actually an ancestral mechanism for animals. But as I said, at a molecular level, it was poorly understood because many more organisms, many more traditional model organisms, used this inheritance mechanism than didn't. All right. So we set about to establish a bunch of different basally branching arthropod models in our lab, including the cricket that you've heard about. These are some of the other ones that we use, this milkweed bug, this spider. And for all of these, what we did was examine molecular and genetic and embryological evidence for the presence or absence of maternally supplied signals for requirement for zygotic gene activity and signaling to establish germ cells. And I'll just summarize the findings of those studies by saying that in all of these animals, we found that the hypothesis that best explained all of our observations was that zygotic mechanisms and not maternal determinants were establishing germ cells in these organisms. Furthermore, we had a clue from Kyrillus that they required the presence of mesoderm in order for a germline to be established, which is similar to the mouse system because the germline is established from a subset of mesoderm upon receipt of signals of the BMP signaling pathway. And so what we did then was to examine the requirement for the BMP signaling pathway and its specific downstream effector transcription factor called LIMP1 to establish germ cells. And in a nutshell, what Taro and Seth in my lab found with help from a few other lab members is that the utility of these specific ligands, these specific BMP2, 8, and 4 ligands, rather than other ligands, and the type 1 and 2 receptors, phosphorylation of the downstream effector MAD, and most importantly, because this is the element of BMP signaling in the mouse that makes it germline specific, the utilization of this transcription factor called LIMP1 to translate that BMP signal upstream into activation of a germline program zygotically downstream, all of these elements happen to be conserved also in the cricket. Okay. This was an interesting finding. It was surprising to us. It could mean that BLIMP1-mediated BMP signaling is a shared ancestral feature of animals. It could also not mean that. Sample size is 2, so I'm not claiming that. I will point out that we have investigated, just by reading the literature and works of others, the necessity or sufficiency of BMP signaling for establishing germ cell fate or maintaining it or germline function in a wide number of animals. And we're finding, we think, a non-trivial link between this particular signaling pathway, as opposed to the other 7 that we could have chosen or that exist out there in animals, between this signaling pathway and establishment and functioning and maintenance of the germline. So there may be something to the idea that BMP signaling is ancestrally linked to the establishment of this particular cell type, which is unique to stable multicellularity in animals, okay, and the germline. So that's an interesting finding that we were able to make using this non-traditional model organism based on the clues that, because of its ancestral-looking mode of development, we thought it might exhibit some ancestral features of development, like the establishment of the germline using induction rather than inheritance of maternally supplied determinants. Yes?
How do you know there's no asymmetry, no bias coming from mother for yourselves?
So the evidence that we have that supports that idea is that we've looked at, I guess, about 10 or so different molecular products, transcripts, and proteins that in Drosophila are asymmetrically localized to the germplasm, and we've asked if they're asymmetrically localized in oocytes or early embryos, and they're not. We've asked if they're required maternally for establishment of the germline, and they are not. And we have also done an experiment where we've removed the posterior 10% of the cytoplasm, which is where germplasm is in insects that have it, and they're still able to establish a germline. That's the extent of it. Yes.
Like you said, I missed it. So Medea is presumably everywhere.
Yes. definitely.
So why is it going through blimp 1 as opposed to whatever else it's going through in other places?
That's a great question. So we don't know. So the positional, there's obviously positional information that is intersecting with this signaling pathway. Oh, thank you, that we don't know about. Which board is better, this one or that one?
Equally bad for half the.
Okay, sorry. So at the time that the germline is established, the embryo looks like this, and the germ cells arise over here from a set of mesoderm, okay, in this region. These are the, this is the region, the future A2 to A4 segment region. So where is BMP signaling activity at this time? Okay, BMP ligands are expressed essentially here, okay, ligands. Activation that we interpret as being nuclear localization of phospho-SMAD is also along the entire lateral sides. The receptors and the MADs and the medias are everywhere. Okay, MADs everywhere. So we, and when the experiments, so we could either essentially abolish this by RNA interference, or we tried to raise the levels of BMP signaling to see if we could find an argument for sufficiency. And we were able to do it, but what we were able to do was simply sort of expand the region within which BMP signaling was active, but we didn't get ubiquitous high levels of BMP signaling. We always got a lower level in that midline. So we suspect that there is a repressor along that midline, and we're searching right now for a SOG orthologue, and maybe we have one, we're not really clear. So there, we're hypothesizing there must be a repressive activity along the ventral midline that we can't detect. When we did, though, achieve these higher levels of BMP signaling all up and down this lateral side, we got more germ cells in the correct places, but we also got ectopic germ cells too far posterior and too far anterior than normal. So we may have been overriding some of the positional information that we think must exist and normally restrict germ cell making just to this region. So now we're investigating the possibility that HOX genes, which we know are assigning some kind of regional identity, are intersecting with this to create that, I don't want to say French flag, but some kind of intersecting positional information. Yep. So this is as far as we're
going. The tissue that is on the same medial lateral axis, but at different AP level, what does it produce?
The mesoderm that's in these regions, so the germ cells arise immediately adjacent to some mesodermal structures which are segmentally repeated called celomic pouches. And these create the specialized trunk mesoderm for each segment and the appendage mesoderm for the appendage-bearing segments. And then these germ cells, they form, there are sort of 15 of them, 10 or 15 of them in a little cluster in each of the three segments right beside those celomic pouches. So what the specific fate is, if they have analogs or homologs in each specific segment, I don't know.
So the celomic pouches, would they be equivalent to somites?
They are not equivalent to somites. They are true coeloms. They are mesodermally
enlarged. But in terms of the tissue they generate?
They are not. They are paired in every segment. I know that you have these chevrons. I don't know if you would consider it, you know, in the zebrafish system.
It's more the cell types which are generated from that tissue.
Well, what are the cell types that somites generate after they are formed as somites?
Muscle, skeleton, cartilage.
Muscle, yes, not skeleton. not cartilage. And the exoskeleton is secreted by the epidermis, by the ectoderm. So in some sense, they are analogous in that they provide the segmental muscle derivatives, but not all. We know that there are some longitudinal muscles that don't derive from the celomic pouches.
And if you reduce BMP signaling, what do those cells become? The cells that should have become PGCs?
We don't know. We don't have a way of sort of lineage tracing them. We can just assess their absence or presence by the molecular markers that they have that are enriched, and we just see that they are diminished or absent, those cells. Other questions about this? All right. Okay, so crickets are not using the fly-like system to establish their germline. They are using a mouse-like system. And so we wanted to ask about one key feature of the fly-like system, which is, I've said that germplasm is necessary and sufficient to establish germ cells in flies. There is one gene that encodes a key germplasm component, and that gene is itself necessary and sufficient to establish germplasm, and therefore the germline in Drosophila, and that gene is called OSCAR. Okay, so this is a very crude schematic of, you know, four of the 8,000 players that are involved in germ cell, in germplasm and Drosophila, but I just want to say that OSCAR is at the top of this germplasm assembly hierarchy, interacting physically with at least some of the protein products of some of these genes. And another thing that I want to point out is that, in some sense, if we want to understand the repeated evolution of using an inheritance-based mechanism to establish a germline in animals, which is what the phylogenetic pattern is telling us has happened, that independently, multiple times, germplasm has evolved convergently, then one way that we can think about having to understand that problem is we need to understand how the germline fate markers, which are conserved in all animals, are triggered and assembled and enriched in the cell type. In the inheritance, in the induction system, you do this by triggering, we think, de novo transcription of these genes. But in the OSCAR system, you assemble physically the products of these genes that are being transcribed maternally, and you pre-assemble them all together in the region of cells that will become germ cells, rather than having to turn them on later. So in one sense, understanding the evolution of a germplasm system involves understanding the evolution of a key magnet or an assembly mechanism for these germline components. Yes?
Yes. Does it make any sense to go for this concept of the phenotypic stage to sort of address the sort of problem that the one that you are asking is?
Probably.
You know, there's this stage, mm-hmm, with mm-hmm. the morphology of Drosophila and Gryllus mm-hmm. converge, and mm-hmm. mm-hmm. that is like.
Probably not, because the germline, so the phylotypic stage model, for those of you who may not have heard of it, let me bias the other side now. It's also called the hourglass model, where you have this constrained stage where things look similar. And by things, people mean morphologies and maybe gene expression patterns, or maybe not gene expression, but maybe the genes that are used. Okay, maybe not the genes that are used, maybe the age of the genes that are used. Okay, people who are hot about the phylotypic stage theory will find many different things that they will claim are similar at this stage. Okay. But the idea is that there are, in early development, so this is early, and so this is time, developmental time, that early on, embryos can look really different. And later on, they also look really different, all these different types of animals, right? But there's a stage where they all look really similar if you choose your samples correctly. So this is what Monica is asking about. The germline is always established before that stage is reached, however loosely you want to define it. So it counts as one of the things that's really labile.
But you spoke now about those genes which are actually expressing the two systems.
Yes, exactly. Once you become a germ cell, you're going to express the same thing all the time.
But where are we with the expression of those genes in this model?
You already turned them on up here. Yeah. Interestingly, once you become a germ cell, you turn on these genes, which are always the same, and they're old genes. They have existed as long as animals, and many of them or their ancestors predate animals. But when you evolve germplasm convergently, independently, a number of times, this is, now sample size is maybe 3, maybe 4, depending on how you look at it. But you look like you evolve a new gene specific to your lineage that does not have a homolog anywhere else, is disordered, can't be structured, and is a germplasm assembler. There's evidence that that has happened in Drosophila, where it's OSCAR. In C. elegans, the Peggles and the Megs that have been studied by Geraldine Seydoux may fall into that category. In zebrafish, buckyball might be such a gene. And in frogs, no such thing has been found yet, to my knowledge. But that is an interesting.
So you said disordered, can't be structured.
They're biochemically very difficult to work with. They're unstable. They don't fold well, and they have high predicted disorder.
So your germ cells in Gryllus also have this new system?
We're doing EM on them actually right now. They almost certainly have electron-dense granules. Once they are established as germ cells, all cells always have electron-dense stuff. Yeah. And any undifferentiated cell, any type of stem cell also has that stuff in it. And if you can do immuno-EM, it's definitely going to contain peewees and VASAs and DDXs and those things. Yeah. Okay, so some people in the lab have become interested then in this assembly of germplasm problem, in inventing a germplasm nucleator, and so some people in the lab are looking at this OSCAR gene. Okay, now I've talked about holometabolous insects and hemimetabolous insects. One thing that I didn't say is that germplasm has been documented only in the holometabolous insects, only in this clade of indirectly developing guys. In the basally branching clades, including gryllus, germplasm has been documented to be absent. And in gryllus, we also think that's the case. And the other animals I was telling you about that we looked at, we think this is the case. And Jeremy Lynch identified an ortholog of Oscar from WAS about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 2011, published a very nice plastogenetics paper. And that was a very exciting finding because up until that time, people had only been able to identify Oscar in different flies and in a couple of mosquitoes, which are the furthest derived group of insects of all of the insects. And so there was an idea for a while that Oscar was just a dipteran-specific thing. Dipterans are flies and mosquitoes. But when Jeremy found it in a wasp, which belongs to the Hymenoptera, ants, bees, wasps, which are the most basally branching group of holometabolous insects, that combined with the fact that germplasm was only observed in holometabolous insects led Jeremy to propose very reasonably that Oscar evolved in the lineage that led to the holometabolous insects and permitted or led to the evolution of this new way of making germ cells, which was making germplasm. We thought that was a great hypothesis and made a lot of sense. But then we found Oscar ortholog in the crickets, which is very surprising to us because we were pretty convinced at that stage the gryllus didn't have germplasm. And in fact, I said to Ben, who had discovered the student in the lab, who said, "I think I found Oscar in crickets." I said, "Probably not Oscar." He said, "No, it's Oscar." I said, "No, it's probably not Oscar." And he was right. It was Oscar ortholog. Okay, so we convinced ourselves it's Oscar ortholog through phylogenetic analysis. We made some reagents against it to interfere with its function. We asked, "What is Oscar doing in an insect that doesn't have germplasm?" And we found it's not doing any of the things that it's doing in Drosophila in terms of germplasm. So when we knocked down, so here's an example of some experiments we did. We knocked down Oscar using RNA interference, and we find that here's one abdominal segment of a control cricket embryo. Anterior is up, posterior is down. Here are these little clusters of germ cells that I was trying to draw on the board there. We marked them with a species-specific antibody against a peewee ortholog from gryllus. And here they are next to, these are the stolomic pouches, these roundy-looking things here. Dappy is just showing us all of the nuclei in blue. Our control animals have germ cells in the right places, and our knockdown animals also have germ cells in the right places. So we said, well, maybe they don't have enough germ cells. No, we counted them, they have the right number. We said, maybe germ cells are not working. No, germ cells are fine. These animals are fertile. We said, well, Oscar is localizing posterior determinants as well as germplasm in Drosophila. Maybe they have their anterior-posterior axis compromised. No, anterior-posterior axis is fine. So all of these jobs that Oscar is doing in Drosophila, very well known, Oscar is not necessary for these jobs in crickets. Oscar expression in Drosophila is... Oh, yes, Madhav. Yeah.
You said Oscar is one of these disordered...
It is.
So you're saying we don't know the biochemical role mechanistically of Oscar even in Drosophila.
That is...
Or is that known?
That is essentially correct. What do we know about Oscar biochemically? No one has been able to purify or crystallize the entire thing. Ruth Lehmann's lab, Anna Frisley's lab, and our lab have been able to crystallize and solve the structures of the two domains within Oscar that will fold up by themselves. One of them, there's biochemical evidence that it is a RNA binding domain. The other one, there is biochemical evidence that it is a protein-protein domain that it can dimerize at least with itself. We know, most of what we know about Oscar's mechanism comes from genetics. If you move Oscar, other things move.
Right.
But biochemically, there are a couple of specific mRNAs that have been suggested fairly strongly to biochemically interact with Oscar. But that is the limit of our knowledge right now about the biochemical mechanism. It's quite poor.
But Nuage is not forming Oscar, by the
way. Correct, because Nuage is a manifestation of germplasm. Exactly. Exactly. So one of the things that we're trying to do then is figure out the biochemical mechanism of fly Oscar and compare it to biochemical mechanism or ability of cricket Oscar to see to what extent can we explain how come one Oscar can do one thing, other Oscar cannot do it. So it's not doing the traditional fly Oscar roles. The fly Oscar is expressed specifically in the germline during embryogenesis. Okay, cricket Oscar, I'm not showing you the expression pattern here, but it is found at very low levels before germ cells form in all of the mesodermal cells and throughout. But at a little bit later stage of development, where we see an enrichment of Oscar transcript, which is in purple, and protein, which is in black, is in the neuroblasts. You learned about neuroblasts from Marcos the other day. These are these asymmetrically dividing stem cells of the nervous system that form all of the neurons of the nervous system in all pancreastations, insects, and crustaceans. Okay. This is where Oscar protein is found in these crickets. And so what we did was, in our knockout animals, then we turned to the nervous system and asked if we saw any defects, and this is where we saw some defects. So I'm just showing you a couple of examples of defects that we saw. The top row is going to be controls, and what I'm showing is the labeled axonal scaffold of the embryonic nervous system. It looks like a ladder in all arthropods, where you have these longitudinal connectives and these anterior and posterior commissures in each segment. And many aspects of the axonal scaffold are disrupted in Oscar RNAi animals. So one disruption is that these longitudinal connectives are often too thin or they're broken. We also see problems with the anterior and the posterior commissures, which fail to form in this particular example that I'm showing you, or sometimes their formation is delayed, or instead of forming two nice separate anterior commissures, these are fused, so they have morphological defects. These are all going to be axon scaffolding, axon organization defects that are often, in turn, in Drosophila, caused by neuronal specification defects. So we asked if we could detect neuronal specification defects that are similar to the ones seen in Drosophila mutants that will give you axonal scaffold phenotypes like these. Examples of these loss of function conditions in Drosophila include Miranda, for example. And indeed, we found that there were neuronal specification defects in our Oscar knockdown crickets. So here's an example of, we did even skip in situ hybridization to reveal these six specific neuronal subtypes. Doesn't even matter what they are, they're just six known, easy to identify neurons that are established from obviously in every segment. And we saw that in our Oscar knockdowns, these guys are incorrect in number or missing. Okay. So here's some of the examples. And we found, I'm not going to show it here, but we've also investigated whether or not Oscar plays any role in adult nervous system function in the crickets. And we found that indeed, Oscar is required for the maintenance of long-term memory in adult crickets. So another role in the nervous system for Oscar in crickets, which there's no evidence for such a role of Oscar in Drosophila. So again, using this non-traditional model organism, we were able to uncover some pretty surprising things. Yeah?
How do you, just out of curiosity, check for long-term memory in crickets?
You just talk to them. So there's our collaborator, Makoto Mizunami at the University of Hokkaido, does these experiments with us. So they are a lab that is dedicated full-time to cricket memory. And so what you do is, it's an olfactory learning paradigm, where you deprive the crickets of water for a couple of days. They're a little bit thirsty. Then you offer them water associated with an odor. And they use vanilla and peppermint. Normally, they don't like vanilla very much. They prefer peppermint under normal conditions when they have enough water. But you associate the water with the odor they don't normally like. But they will go to it because they're thirsty. So you train them like this for a few hours. Then you ask, after 1 hour, when presented with the two odors, there's no water reward now, which odor are they preferring? And 1 hour, when they still go towards the trained odor, is short-term memory, and 1 day after training is long-term memory. So this is the paradigm that we use. Yes?
What do you know, so is it a an absence of specification of normal numbers of neurons, or is it a loss of total neurons?
And we find that with the particular subset of neurons that we looked at, there were too few of them established.
All of them, though? So does even skips mark all of the neurons?
It doesn't. Okay. It marks a particular subset. There are six repeated sets of neurons in every segment. We just looked at those because absence of those is known to cause defects in the axonal scaffold of the type that we saw.
Yeah, but so do you end up with proportionally other neurons?
We do not know this. Okay. Yeah. We also have no idea if these neuronal defects that we observed in embryonic development have anything to do with the loss of memory in the adult.
Yeah.
Right. So we're creating, using CRISPR, an actual Oscar mutants now, so that we can ask that type of question. Yeah.
Oh, I think she was first.
Are there any other sensory or motor defects that are seen in these RNAi?
Not that we have looked at. They're running around, they're jumping, they're mating, everything is good. We're not behavioral biologists, but they look okay. So we definitely know, for example, it's not a lack of olfaction. They can smell things. They can walk towards the So these basic things, at least we can say, they look okay. Yeah.
If I remember correctly, Oscar mRNA has itself a very important role within Drosophila germline specification. Do you know if this is the case also for these phenotypes that you are seeing?
So in Drosophila, there's a protein null allele that still generates RNA, and it's been shown that that's very important for oogenesis. We have no such allele to assess this in these guys, but I can tell you that when we do maternal knockdown, so we inject double-stranded RNA into the abdomen of the mother and we knock down 95% of the transcript and the protein in the ovaries, oogenesis is still okay. That's all I can say for that.
So in Drosophila, the other one thing which is in the germline in this pathway that is in neurons and in neural differentiation is pumilin.
Yes.
and then this Pumukel gene as well. And who? I was wondering how is Pumukel.
Pumukel, okay, I don't know him. Okay. But Pumilio, yes.
It's a cartoon in German, actually. Uh-huh. He was in Harry Dick's lab, actually. Then the question is, what about Pumilio in those?
So we know that Pumilio is transcript is enriched in the neuroblasts in crickets, but we haven't yet knocked it out. And we don't yet know whether or not it is. It might be interacting with Oscar.
They do.
And so other guys that we're investigating that we know interact either with Oscar in the germline of Drosophila or in neuroblasts asymmetrically are Stauffen and Miranda. We will also check. So we're trying to look at those also, but we don't know yet.
So I might have missed it, but did you do the knockdowns in the early NIMP stages?
No.
Because it could be cool to look if they are involved in any specification or rearrangement of the neurons during nymphal transitions to adulthood.
Yes. No, we haven't looked at that. We did our embryonic guys,
yeah.
And then we did the full adulthood. Okay, so just to wrap up this section, I was just trying to make the point that using this relatively understudied cricket model organism, we were able to uncover a few things that were interesting, not only about the biology of this particular cricket, but that we think have led us to be able to ask questions about the evolution of these genetic systems that control these things. And the Oscar gene, for example, is a really interesting study of that. So we think that germplasm is a derived mode of specification. We have some molecular evidence to support that idea. This cell-cell signaling mechanism seems to be more prevalent and is likely ancestral in animals. And then we have this potential co-option of Oscar from one role to another role over the course of insect evolution that may have had something to do with the derived evolution of this germplasm mechanism in this one lineage Drosophila. All right. So in the last 20 minutes or so, half hour, I'll tell you about our attempts to build some tools to try to study quantitatively what's happening in the early embryo of gorillas, because I think it's quite different from what's happening in Drosophila. So as you know, if you're an animal and you're making an embryo, you can cleave in one of two ways. You can undergo complete cytokinesis, and you're called holoblastic, or you don't, and you're called syncytial. And syncytial cleavage, we know a ton about it from Drosophila, and you heard some great work that's being done in Lars's group recently on this, but I just want to remind you about the phylogenetic distribution of syncytial cleavage relative to holoblastic cleavage. So this is a very simplified phylogenetic relationship between a small number of animals, right? We've really highly simplified this. It's mainly arthropods. And we just simplify this so that we can make the point that the only syncytially cleaving organisms, really truly speaking, during embryogenesis are the insects. And so we think that syncytial cleavage, based on molecular clocks that are dating insects, arose around 500 million years ago or so, close to the emergence of insects. So despite its being a sort of freakish one-off occurrence, we know a ton about it because Drosophila happens to use it. Okay. So Drosophila uses it, and Lars, as you saw, is elucidating very nicely the mechanics and the quantitative aspects of how these nuclei divide and fill up the space. And as you heard, they expand and fill up that space of the egg space in a kind of expanding shell way. But as you may have been able to appreciate from these early time lapses in crickets, at least just by the naked eye, they're not doing it in as coordinated or uniform a way as Drosophila is. And so we're trying then, using the different types of microscopy that you've already heard about, to understand what are the dynamics that are governing these movements in gorillas. So that's one thing that they're definitely doing, we think, differently from Drosophila, or by eye they appear to be, which is filling that space or that axial expansion process. And the other thing that they're doing quite differently, as you've heard again, is assembling the actual embryonic rudiment, where in Drosophila, almost all of the cells of the blastoderm here are going to form that embryonic rudiment. But by contrast, in gorillas, only a subset of the cells in the posterior ventral region will come together, first forming two lateral condensations, which will then fuse on the lateral midline to form this butterfly-shaped early embryonic rudiment. So these are the two things that, at the beginning, we've chosen to focus on to see if we can generate some quantitative analysis of how axial expansion occurs, that filling of the space, and then the coalescence of some of the cells into one region to form that embryonic rudiment. So we've used two different types of microscopy so far to do this. One is the light sheet that you've heard about already, so I'm not even going to go into that. And the other is something called a cell observer, and I want to tell you about this because Seth has turned into a real MacGyver and is devising all these little doodads to mount embryos in large numbers. So he's made this little sort of IKEA diagram with these pieces of plastic that he makes a nice agarose mold in that can hold about 100 embryos, and the grid is all labeled, so you can really track embryo by embryo for a long period of time. So you put your agarose in there, you put your embryos in, you invert it, and then you've got it into a cover slip containing petri dish, and now you can observe your embryos in these little troughs, and every trough has an identifier. So it's a very handy way for us to observe many embryos at once, albeit at slightly lower resolution. And it's very easy to make if you've got access to a laser cutter. And Seth is now like making custom orders for different shaped embryos. One of our colleagues works on this weird Colombian frog or this acial flatworm. So you can make custom things for your embryos. So these different types of microscopy, obviously, as you've learned, will give you different types of information. The light sheet or the spin-based method is a very low sample size mechanism. We can only observe really one embryo at a time, and we can observe it over around 500 time points, a few minutes apart. We can take these images about 5 minutes apart because Rhillus is very slow compared to Drosophila. With this cell observer method, with this little grid, we can observe many more, but we're essentially getting two-dimensional information. I mean, there's a little bit of Z-depth, but it's not amazing. But we can gather sort of bigger picture views of many different embryos at once, because we know that there's a huge amount of variability, you know, within a strain and from day to day and so on. So we want to increase our sample size, albeit with slightly lower resolution power, by doing this type of analysis as well simultaneously. So these are the two ways that we've tried to gather the data. And I'm going to just in the next few minutes tell you some of the extremely preliminary observations that we're making using these types of data. So first I'll talk about this actual expansion process. So this actual expansion process, this would be the relative size of a Drosophila egg and a Gryllus egg right here. And what these different diagrams are showing you are relative sizes of other known insect eggs and where the first few cleaving nuclei are relative to the egg. And you can see that they're not always centered. And so in a case like Gryllus or in a case like this massive blowfly here, you might wonder if you're really going to have an expanding shell model whereby every region of your shell is expanding in the same way, in a uniform way. Is that really the way that you can fill up this space or not? And the other thing to keep in mind is that the relative dedication of embryonic territory, cellular territory, to embryonic in orange versus extraembryonic in blue is also highly variable across different insects and across these different sizes of eggs. So these are the two main differences we want to think about when we're thinking about Gryllus. What we do is we make these time-lapse movies in the ways that I've told you about with those microscopy techniques. We've used iLASTIC to identify and automatically track these nuclei, and we've heard about iLASTIC already in this course, so I won't go into it. And I'll tell you now about some of the very preliminary observations that we've made. So the first thing is we're tracking the speeds and the directions of the nuclei. So if we just consider now speed, this is going to be a two-dimensional projection showing the relative speeds of different nuclei, color-coded with this heat map here where the slow nuclei are blue and the red ones are fast. And it will hopefully loop a couple of times, and you can just start to get a feel by eye for the distribution of speeds. And I've already said distribution of speed, so I'm already hinting to you that the speed of nuclei is not going to be uniform across at least one of space or time axis. And so this should play from maybe around 8 nuclei through to before we begin to assemble an embryonic rudiment. I'm sorry, I should have said, it's here, right here, posterior is towards me. And so the coalescence of the embryonic rudiment is going to take place over here. As we play it again, we can see that at the beginning of development, there's more heterogeneity in speed. And as development proceeds and we create a blastoderm, it's not uniform, but that heterogeneity of speed smooths out and everybody slows down and becomes more uniformly slow. But at the beginning of development, hopefully you may have gotten the impression, this was certainly our impression, and when we quantified it, it turned out to be the case, that the fastest moving nuclei were at the anterior and the posterior, and particularly the anterior. So this might suggest that one of the ways that they are expanding is that the nuclei at the anterior and posterior are moving faster than the ones in the middle. It is not a uniformly expanding shell. And the top and the... Yes?
Does the speed correlate with the subdivision events? Because when you look at the movie, you can see that the sediment distribution that really moved about very fast. So
that's a good question. So you'll see in the next couple of slides that there is some relationship between speed and cell division in the following way. Immediately after a cell has divided, that is the time in its life when it will move the fastest. Mm-hmm. However, that's not enough to explain the difference in speed over here versus over there. In other words, we don't see more cell divisions at the anterior, at the two ends. Yeah, that's a great question,
Do they are jamming to each other at all? Like, it seems like they go faster when they have more space to run.
That's a great question. So we're trying to figure out whether or not a simple density sensor mechanism model could explain this. The real answer is we don't know. We haven't seen nuclei jam into each other. We haven't finished quantifying whether or not there's always a minimum space maintained. And I'll tell you a little bit, I mean, all I can do is show you a picture of how we're trying to do the experiment. We're trying to change the density of the nuclei in different regions of the embryo to ask this question. But what I can say is that we don't observe nuclear divisions. And we're being, I will also say, extremely conservative in our tracking. So Lars talked about being able to confidently track 99.8009% of the cells, which is fantastic. We cannot do this. And we're being very hesitant because we don't want to assume things. So whenever nuclei come too close, we just don't even have faith that we can distinguish them. But we have not seen, just by eye, I can tell you, we haven't seen collisions.
Does it only seem to me that there's actually less density in the posterior here?
That's an interesting question. So initially, the density is highest here, which is where the female pronucleus is. And so this is where initial divisions happen. But I guess we would have to say maybe there is some bin of time or space that we could find. There certainly would be very early where we could say that density is less here. But at the time that the embryo coalesces, which takes place over here, I don't believe that density is less here. Is that what you're asking?
Well, I'm just comparing anterior and posterior, right?
Yes.
You start at very low density, but it looks like anterior is filling up faster, at least.
Yes.
Than the posterior, and just wondering if lower nuclear density in posterior has anything to do with all the fun stuff that's going to happen there later.
Mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm. I think we haven't binned it in a way that we can answer that question. But that would be something we should look at.
Have you looked at the cytoskeleton for this period? Is it?
No, not yet. So Tara has just been able to make a membrane labeled line, and there was we lost the microtubule transfer.
So you fixed them or anything else?
No, we haven't yet. We are trying to do that now, but no, we haven't yet.
Two questions. This is a spinal 3D?
Yes.
Did you do an MSD analysis on those nuclei?
What's that?
Meaningful displacement? Did you see the diffusive and the rest of the
components? No, we haven't. No, we haven't. We've just analyzed their sort of relative speed and their angles, but we haven't done that.
Do you have any lineages for this yet?
A little bit. It's very preliminary. I'll get to that in a few slides.
I'm asking because, I mean, is there any sort of a pattern where one of the divided cells, nuclei, is doing more movement around and the other one is more stationary?
Oh, we haven't seen any correlation like that on the very limited lineage information that we have. Yeah.
Are you distinguishing between the surface nuclei and the ones still in the yolk?
We are not. Having said that, at the time that this movie starts, almost all of them are close to the surface. But this movie does not contain depth information.
Even interior?
Sorry?
Is it even interior? Because it seems to me that the moment they basically surface, they settle down, right? They go to a different mode and settle down.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ones interior that you see moving so fast, they might still basically be dividing inside of the yolk, right?
Yes.
And so maybe that mode just gives you faster, you know, like at least a means of larger displacement.
It could be. We haven't parsed out that contribution of depth yet.
Do you actually see the yolk flow at these stages?
No, we haven't. So we have some data where we've injected some beads, some of the same registration beads, into the yolk to try to observe yolk flows that way, but we don't know yet what kind of correlation there is that might suggest that flows are moving them. Yeah. Is there a question at the back? I felt like there was.
Yeah, I was just wondering if division is uniform across the whole egg, basically.
We haven't finished the quantification, but I'll bet $50 that yes. Yeah, that's about how confident I am.
The speed at which it happens?
The speed at which division happens.
So, like, is the cycle faster less movement of?
We have not seen that type of correlation. We have seen that division is not uniform, and I'll try to show that in a couple of slides in time. But in space, we haven't yet detected any non-uniformity of division patterns. Yeah?
So is there any known way by which AI can propel itself? So meaning, it's probably a diffusion problem, right?
I think that's what Marcos is getting at. Can we explain these movements by diffusion alone, or must there be some active propulsion?
They're energids.
At the beginning of the movie, they are energids, and what Matt means by that is nuclei surrounded by a thin veil of cytoplasm, because cellularization has not happened yet. I haven't even talked about this, but in cellularization, in Drosophila, you probably remember that this axial expansion happens in this expanding shell situation, and you populate the cortex with nuclei, and then the single lipid bilayer of the egg interdigitates in between each nucleus, simultaneously around the circumference of the blastoderm, simultaneously forming membranes for everybody, right? And then seals off on the basal side. That is not happening here. What happens in these early syncytial divisions is that they're early in syncytial, just like in Drosophila, they reach the cortex at different times and cellularize, if not at different times, certainly independently of each other, physically independently of each other. Okay. What we can, I'll get to it if I have time. I will get to it at the end, where we think some of the movements that we see we can explain because cellularization has been achieved. But that's what I can say about that. Yes.
Are these nuclei much bigger than the Drosophila?
No.
Same size.
Yeah, Matt.
So I just had a question. You might be going into the variability between the X, because a lot of people, I think, have been watching this movie over and over, but if you show the grid, then there was tremendous variability in where the nuclei come up and the densities of posterior and anterior and so on.
Yeah. Our sample size is too small. We can't say.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Okay. So speed is not the same in space or in time of these nuclei. They're not moving in an expanding shell. This is one way we're trying to represent a lot of that information, maybe too much at once, with the anterior-posterior axis of the egg on the x-axis and developmental time going up on the y-axis. So we begin with a few nuclei that are located, and these are the positions and speeds of the nuclei that we observe. So we begin with a small number of nuclei, just about 8 of them, located a little bit closer to the posterior half-ish of the embryo, and as they divide, every time you see a branching event, the nucleus has divided, and as they divide, what you can see is that there's more red and orange towards the outsides of the graph, towards the anterior and posterior, which corresponds to what you observed in the previous slide, which is that the nuclei at the anterior and the posterior ends move faster than the ones in the middle. Yeah, that's what I'll say about that. What you might also be observing, and this came back to somebody's question about their speed relative to cell divisions, is that when they are slower moving, they're not always uniformly slower moving. It almost looks like there are kind of blue and white stripes here, as if there were coordinated or coincident times when the nuclei move faster and then they move a little slower. They move faster within the sort of slow speed. Okay. And we think that that is actually what is happening. We think that there are bursts that are a little bit synchronized, not as much as Drosophila, but a little bit bursts of speed, and we think that these little bursts of speed correspond to what you had asked about, which is immediately after they have divided, this is the fastest movement of their life. Okay, and on the next couple slides, I'm going to show you the way that we've looked at the data that make us think that this is what is happening. This is a snapshot of just a first few cleavages. Mara.
Just a question about the ones that start making the embryo.
Yeah.
Are cells predetermined, are there nuclei in this field that are predetermined to make that tissue and then go to the right region? Or is it the nuclei that end up in the right region, take on that fate, and then do the business?
This is what we want to know. So we don't know yet. I think that from very early on, from maybe the first 3, 4, 5 cleavages, nuclei whose daughters will contribute to extraembryonic versus embryonic has already been determined.
How far up in the previous slide was that? Just to get way back. Oh, wow.
We think. Small sample size, preliminary. I'm not betting more than $25. So, but I think that at least extraembryonic versus embryonic, this is how you tell how strongly I think something, right? I have a bet with one of my students that if he does a certain experiment and gets a certain result, I will eat a can of wet cat food. That's how sure I am that he is wrong in his hypothesis. So I haven't even put money on it. I just put cat food. But yes, so my suspicion, but only $25 worth, is that from the 4 or 8 nucleus stage, some of those nuclei have already decided, I will only make embryonic cells, or I will only make extra-embryonic cells.
This is really fascinating. When I look at this, I agree with you. So they seem to be slowing down when they divide, right? So
yes.
Slow down and then speed up and so on.
Yes.
And these trajectories look pretty straight to me, so I would wager that there is something active in there.
Aha. Uh-huh. Active moving them, you mean?
Active moving, yes.
Active contributing to the speed.
Yeah.
Because of, can you say that again? Why do you think that's...
Because the trajectories are straight. If it's just diffusion on that scale, you would...
I see. Oh, okay. That's interesting. Yeah.
If there were some repulsive force, there was some diffusible signal coming out of the nuclei, you would expect this sort of fanning out. It wouldn't necessarily be active.
Yes.
But the force would be very dense in the middle, and it would fan out
towards the edge. That's right. Yeah, so that would be consistent with it. Yes, so it's sort of a kind of, it's maybe I think what you're saying is it could be explained by a density sensor model, potentially.
Yeah. The trucks that doesn't enter the top of the time, is it cell death, or is it just loss of the track?
These are, we have lost the track.
Yeah. There's no cell death during this overview.
Not that we have observed in a wild type embryo,
But by the end of this process, what is the percentage of cells that contribute to each of the different tissues?
I don't know. I think it is about 30-70, 70 extra embryonic, 30 embryonic, but we have not quantified this yet.
So it wouldn't mean that you wouldn't be able to do the decision very early, because if they divide a lot, then it's very early, so it'd be...
Unless you have unequal division rates among lineages.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm a bit illiterate on the subject, but the system that kind of controls these mitotic waves in Drosophila, do you think that could be kind of breaking up, because this is a much, much bigger egg?
Could be. People ask about, you know, how scalable are these things that are reliant on diffusible things. Hard to say. I can say that there are fly embryos, other fly species, that are at least as big as this guy, that have very nice synchronous cleavages. So, yeah.
Sam, so I'm still thinking about the question and answer about how early the termination occurs, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess we can imagine that the tree lineage is in animals, but one can also imagine that it is simply positioned.
Position.
Correct. And here, I guess, so the quantitative question is, how much twisting is there in those lineages? Mm-hmm. To what extent anterior-posterior ordering is preserved by this tree?
Yeah.
And very crudely, just looking at how you mapped it very nicely onto the plane, it sort of looks like there is not a hell of a lot of twirling.
Yes. We think that nuclei, when they are cells, they don't travel very far to become part of the embryonic rudiment, which is forming only in a small area. Yeah, that's right. So we can't distinguish then, because of that, because the lineages stay essentially in their neighborhood, we can't distinguish yet. So to try to do this, we will try to move nuclei that are born in one place to another place. This is the cat food experiment my student is wrong about. But we will try to move nuclei from one place to another place to see if they know where they're from or they just blend into the neighborhood. Exactly. Yeah.
So the blue and white stripes that you see, right? So what is the time interval between them?
Small minutes. Minutes.
And
less than five.
These are movements in plane since they don't move laterally, right?
Yes.
Is there any bias in that direction?
Not that we have noticed around what is essentially that dorsoventral. Okay, so let me talk a little bit. Let me do a thing. Let me skip this just because I don't want to go too over. And I do want people are just in the lineage situation, so I want to talk about that. So let me talk a little bit about the directionality of their movement and then the very baby lineage information that we are trying to have. So here what I want to talk about is our attempts to assess the angular movement. And this is a little bit Gornet Boris's question. Is there a bias in the way that they are moving, in the directions that they are moving as they fill up this space? We've talked about the heterogeneity of the seed. And so now we're going to talk about the heterogeneity or lack thereof, whatever, in the directions that they are moving. And so what I'm going to show you in a couple of slides is a movie that's going to have three elements. It's going to have the video that you just saw, but I've just tilted the embryo a little bit, so anterior is up over here, this XY projection of these nuclei, and we're seeing their speeds with the heat map. The central panel is going to show you a Rose diagram showing the bin counts of the angles in which they are moving. And so basically, you know, the size, and we've also just put a heat map on top of that. The hotter colors, the red, are more nuclei are moving in the direction that this wedge is facing, and the cooler colors are fewer nuclei are moving in those directions. So in this particular snapshot of this embryo, at this particular moment, there were more nuclei moving towards the anterior and towards the posterior than there were moving towards the dorsal and ventral sides. And then the third Rose diagram that you're going to see, again, moving dynamically with this, is what proportion, what was the average speed of embryos that were moving in a given direction, so the velocity-angle relationship. So these three things are going to play simultaneously, and it will loop, and hopefully it won't be too epilepsy-inducing, and you will be able to distinguish some patterns. And hopefully what you will see is what we think is happening, which is that initially there's essentially a lot of heterogeneity in the speed and in the velocity by angle, and then that heterogeneity smooths out. So as they divide, they're moving at many different angles, but over time, if we just look at the angle bin counts, but over time, we establish this pattern of generally, if you're moving, you're moving towards the anterior and the posterior more than you are to the sides. Initially, everybody was going in many, many directions, but over time, you will, the most of the directed movement or the angular movement we're finding is taking place towards the anterior and the posterior.
But here, maybe the lack of trend at the beginning is also affected by the sample size, right? At the beginning, you have less nuclei, right? So even if there was a trend, it's not so strong, you would miss it because the sample size is less.
Maybe, although we were hoping to minimize that potential problem just with this graphical representation, which is just of all the nuclei that you have, which proportion of them are moving in this angle or that angle. So, does that make sense? So basically, all of these things have to sum up to the same. All of these things have to sum up to the same. So the Rose diagram is always just showing you the relative amounts of all the nuclei that you do have, how many of them are moving in this direction or that direction.
Yeah, but if you have a bias, which is not very strong, if your sample size is small, you don't pick it up. But if your sample size is very big, then you pick it up.
It's possible. So what you're saying is that this bias might also be extremely strong right at the beginning of development?
Or that this bias exists at the beginning, but you don't pick it up because your samples, you know, the number of nuclei is very small.
It could be. I think I need to think a little bit more about whether or not we've eliminated that. Yeah.
Couldn't part of this also be a projection artifact? Because on your lateral sides, right, basically the movement this way is now going downwards. So you're not picking this up in this 2D map, right?
Say that again.
So
when we project?
If you take the outside, whatever I call this, right, the cells that still move basically along the surface this way, they would, in this projection, just move downwards, which you can see in the 2D projection. But their anterior-posterior movement you still pick up.
So you're saying that the cells that are right at the cortex here.
Exactly. You can pick up their their lateral movement, anterior, posterior. But the movement that basically goes around the circumference, you can't see because it's curved there and it goes into the plane.
I see.
You need to do this analysis with the spin movie with Sebastian's projection.
This is a projection of a spin movie.
Yeah, but not with the projection, but with the unwrapped cylindrical projection.
I see.
So that you don't have any.
I see what you're saying. So we have, that's a good point. So we should apply that to this stage. We have done that at a later stage when we're looking at coalescence to see whether or not these directions are coordinated with respect to those of the embryo. But we haven't done that unwrapping at this early stage. I see what you're saying. Yes, that's a good point.
Cassandra?
Yeah.
In Drosophila, they managed to get the yolk containing nuclei out of the egg and put it into different constrained shapes.
Yeah.
So one way to address this is to take the yolk out, if you can do it in gorillas, and put it into a ball.
Yeah.
And then see whether you're still getting directional bias or whether you basically make the whole thing go the other way around. Can you do this? Can you extract the yolk and keep nuclear divisions going?
We haven't tried. Probably we will be able to. And if we can't do what I would love to do, which is to move nuclei born in one place to some other place, then we're going to resort to that type of thing. I think it's going to be very... I think what we'll be able to potentially make an argument for capturing in that type of assay is intrinsic versus extrinsic properties of speed, cleavage behavior, spindle behaviors, that type of thing. I'm less confident that we'll be able to preserve any information about axes, because we will lose axes, I think. But cortex versus yoke, anterior versus posterior, if those behaviors are similar or different, hopefully we'll be able to capture that, yeah.
Could it just be because you have more space up and down than left and right, and therefore they just have to move up and down?
Density model. Could be. Yeah, density model. Exactly. Could be. So to try and address density model, of course, there are a lot of problems, right? What I would love to do, because here's the problem with density model, right? How do you move a nucleus alone and ensure that you have not moved any other potential positional information with it? Okay, formally you cannot. These nuclei are surrounded by a halo of cytoplasm, which has stuff in it. Transcriptional, translational products of them and of other stuff that probably other nuclei made that came to them. Okay, the methods that we have for moving nuclei could physically suck out a blob of cytoplasm that would contain, yes, the nuclei, but also any putative positional information that was in that cytoplasm, and I would move it also at the same time. Okay, problem. We could do something like what, what's his name, Jehom, forget his name, at the CRG is doing, whereas we are going to magnetically move nuclei, right, from one place to another. We get some little magnetic beads associated with these ones, put the magnet here. Yes, but they will also drag their cytoplasmic contents with them, right? And how will we assess? Okay, I don't want to cut off the experiment before we do it, but these are, every experiment will have its caveats. So I'm going to show you a device that Seth is really excited about right now to do an experiment, whose caveats will become obvious. So this horrible-looking device is a torture device for embryos, and what it does is it enables him to position many embryos in these little slots, and these are hairs. I won't tell you who he took the hair from, but you know, apparently it was consensual, and puts the embryos in here, and through these devices, he turns the ratchet, and it constricts the embryos, and he can orient them towards anterior posterior. He can constrict the embryos before cleavages really get going, and then what we're trying to do is to force all of the nuclei into a smaller region, okay, and then assess their dynamics. We do not have data from this, but I just wanted to show you that this is one way in which we are considering doing it, right? So across these little guys, you will see quite a bit of variability, but what we're excited about is two things. One, they're not dying, okay, and two, in many of the embryos, most of the nuclei are staying only in one site. Okay, so perhaps we actually can begin to address a little bit this density model with many caveats using this as one of many techniques that we can try. And of course, the few nuclei that escape sometimes across the noose, they're now in a region of relatively lower density. How is that going to change? Okay, so every experiment that we try to do to address this position versus lineage will have its problems, but I just wanted to let you know this is one thing that we are trying. Yes, Matt.
Do you release any yolks or dry them because the embryos are completely taut?
They're not too bad. You can air dry them a little bit, but they survive. That's why the ratchet has really tiny teeth, so you just ratchet really slowly and it actually works. Okay. Yeah, the tooth size was key, right?
Yeah, this is a lot of. I'm really surprised how much constriction you've gotten going on without popping anything.
Right. Yeah.
So can you untie them like that?
I don't know. Yes. So this will eventually be what we hope can begin to inform us about these problems. Okay. So let me just wrap up by telling you the tiny bit of pseudo-lineage data that we have. We would like to know this question that Madhav asked a long time ago, how we determine these lineages, and of course we're hoping that we can extend these types of approaches even to these types of problems I was talking about earlier, right? You were asking about what happens to the germ cells if they don't form. We'd like to be able to do lineage tracing to study that. So we have a tiny amount of lineage data here. I'm showing you from a stage, and we've traced not quite through to embryonic coalescence, but just before it happens, where are the areas of the embryo that become populated by the descendants of the first four nuclei to form. And just as Boris was suggesting, they, in a sense, don't move too far from their neighborhood, right? The green one, which is in the furthest quadrant from me, all the green descendants end up basically populating that quadrant. They don't seem to travel extremely far. Now, when we're talking about establishment of embryonic versus extraembryonic tissue, this is important because we know that the embryonic tissue forms only from some subset of the most posterior ventral cells. So this could mean that the embryo tissue is restricted to the, being the daughters of only a small number of very early cleavage nuclei, whereas the extraembryonic tissue receives contribution from all four, at least if we're counting that. And this next slide is just showing you this information, but in a three-dimensional representation of where the nuclei go in a space-filling model, where they fill up this embryonic territory. And so we zoom out as we see it. Posterior is up here in this movie. So the embryonic rudiment, we know, will form only from the blue and pink region, but the extraembryonic tissue will form from the region that includes all four colors. So very, very tentatively, we think perhaps that there might be some lineage restriction.
I don't understand how you can discern that from localized signals.
We cannot.
So
cannot.
Don't think a lineage. Okay.
We can't distinguish between a lineage hypothesis and a positional information hypothesis. We can't. All we have now is lineage information. We have no positional information. We have no evidence of asymmetric, asymmetrically distributed anything in the cytoplasm. So I think the only reason that I'm saying that it might be possible that there's a lineage restriction is because lineage data are the only data that we have at the moment. But we absolutely can't rule out the possibility of positional information in the cytoplasm that we just haven't detected yet. So maybe our experiment that we're doing, that another postdoc is doing with this transcriptome on the ANP halves, if we can lineage these guys in some of those knockdowns and we find that they're causal, then that might be the case. Yeah. But we can't distinguish. So let me just finish, and I will just obviously thank the people who did this work, who are Seth, Taro, and Jordan. So Taro, you know. Seth did the cricket work, and Jordan, who's a grad student with Chris Rycroft in the engineering department, has been our collaborator on all of that image analysis that I talked about. Okay, thanks very much, and thanks for your suggestions, both.
Have you looked at microtubules? If so, I mean, does it give you an idea of if they play a role or not?
We have not. We are trying to do this now, but we have not looked at them yet.
How far
these constricted guys develop? We've only gone sort of to just before coalescence, but we haven't tried to keep them alive after that. Yeah. I bet $100 that if we can prevent infection and trivial stuff like that, they'll make an embryo just fine. I don't think they're going to undergo blastocomesis very well, but I bet they'll make all their segments and their appendages are going to be fine.
Do you think maybe the volumes and stuff would be okay if some detachment happening from the rest of the region?
I bet $50 that it will be the same size as a wild-type embryo. Yeah, the same size, made of the same number of cells.
If I remember rightly, going back to stuff done before we were born, Sander did all of these ligation experiments and used it as evidence for positional information in the embryo for blocking diffusible signals coming from poles. So you think you are using the ligation experiments to do that sort of thing? And I suppose it's a possibility that what Sander was seeing was some restriction of where nuclei were going as well. I can't remember what insects he did it on. It wasn't Drosophila, it was something bigger.
It was a number of different insects, but it was not an Orthopteran. But you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So
you
yes.
You haven't looked at self-egg changes, I guess, yet in your...
We haven't. Another thing that we were thinking about trying is centrifugation. Right, another classic Sander technique. So,
yeah. Do you have the experimental setup to be able to do ablations at that early four-cell stage? Because I think that would sort of get to the lineage issue as well, right?
So I think our best bet at ablating is actually going to be physical removal. I don't think we're going to be able to laser ablate that guy because it's so deep in the yolk. But I have some small amount of faith that with the right needle, we could just physically remove a nucleus. And I think that's going to be our best bet to addressing that. Yeah.
So do you think, when I look at this, I think there's a lot of wasted energy dividing up all those nuclei that aren't going to do anything. Do you think they're providing essentially a nurse cell function to the embryo?
No, they are going to do something. They have to make the extraembryonic membrane.
But why is that in bull case?
Because you can't undergo blastocinesis without it. It encloses the yolk.
Yeah. So you need all those cells.
Yeah. It's like a placenta. It definitely needs to be made. It's not going to be part of the animal later, but...
I just had a question related to the ablation stuff. Do you know the old ablation experiment
think the only paper is in German where they're working with the cricket Akita, and they ablate, when the rudiment is forming, the germline's forming, they ablate the entire surface of that, and then it completely regenerates itself.
So your question?
Just about the, this is again about whether positional information is coming innate to the nuclei or provided by external cues.
Yeah, we haven't done that experiment. The closest thing that I can say is that what we have done when I was doing this germplasm thing is we sucked out the posterior 10%, and this had no effect on any patterning and certainly not on germ cell stuff. But if you suck out, you know, 10-20%, just a little bit further anterior to that, then you can mess up their elongation, their axial elongation.
This is like the organizing center that I think Krauss...
I wouldn't call it organizing center. Well, no, I would say you removed the tissue that was supposed to do the stuff.
Yeah.
So it's not there, it can't do it. The rest of it is there. You can make a head and a bit of a thorax, but your abdomen is crappy because you've removed the tissue that's supposed to be the abdomen.
And they're saying that that can't regenerate, whereas if you ablate everything, it regenerates. At least that's in Akita, so maybe it's a species-specific thing.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's right. So, yes. So it could be you remove everything and you start again. And I'm sure there's some early stage at which you can do that. I know stick insects are amazing at that.
The whole question of like regulatory development versus predetermined.
Yeah. And yeah. And there's, and you know, I mean, it's a fascinating question, but we keep asking these questions, but the answer is going to be the same. There's a time after which it's too late to change.
Yeah.
So sometimes I wonder, should I keep asking this question? Because the answer is only going to consist of finding out what that time is. But it's always just going to be a time.
The time is over.
Yes. It's
time for lunch.
Okay.
Let's thank Sandra.
Thanks.
Thank you for...
I'm here for until September, so
please
come around.